community events.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from City Bikes, a worker-owned, cooperatively run, new and used bicycle sales and service shop with two locations on Southeast Ankeny near KBOO. Open 7 days a week for your bicycle commuting needs and online at citybikes.coop. This KBOO program has been made also in part also by the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic ingredients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. I run around town, around, round, and round, with the pedal to the metal, the pedal to whatever. I run around, round, around, round the town, with the pedal to the metal, the pedal to whatever. I run around town, around, round, and round, with the pedal to the metal, the pedal to whatever. I run around, round, around, round the town, with the pedal. Good morning, I'm Tori Bortman, welcoming you to the KBOO Bike Show. Also, a hearty good morning to my co-host, Alon Robb.
Good morning.
Today, we're focusing on cycling and the law. Have you ever been riding along, minding your own business on your commute to work or ride on the weekend and had a car pass you way too close? Or have you been driving and passed a cyclist with what you thought was plenty of room, only to be met at the next stoplight in your rearview mirror with a few choice words or gestures? Well, today our guests will share with you a whole new technology that could change perceptions from both angles. But first, we'd like to introduce local Portland lawyer Ray Thomas.
Good morning, Ray, and good morning, KBOO audience. Our first guest, cyclist and lawyer Ray Thomas, has been for the past two decades at the forefront of defending cyclists and helping make cycling safer across Oregon. Through representing cyclists in and out of court, conducting legal clinics, and authoring Pedal Power, a legal guide for Oregon bicyclists, now in its eighth edition, Ray Thomas has become one of the nation's leading experts on bicycle law. Ray's knowledge is based on the many cases he has handled and his own years on the saddle. Welcome to the show, Ray.
Well, thanks for having me.
The first question is, what exactly is bicycle law?
Well, in 1983, I took one of my lawyer cards and I wrote the words bike lawyer on it. And I took it up to the Bicycle Repair Collective, not too far from the KBOO studio, and put it on the wall. And at that time, what I was doing was writing a series of legal and technical articles with Andy Weislogel in what was then Oregon Cycling. And the reason that I started thinking about how there ought to be a bike lawyer is that I had my first client was a guy who had worked for me at the public defender's office, who was my investigator, and he was on his way to serve a subpoena, and he got hit by a car on his bike. So he had a worker's comp injury, plus he had a personal injury case. And when I looked at the law, what I found was that even though I was a lawyer, I was really surprised by how technical and complex the laws were as they related to bicycles. And I thought, well, goodness, this should be its own specialty area. It certainly deserves it. And what has happened is that I was one of the first practitioners who started to think of themselves as concentrating in that particular area.
And when you did that, you said the bicycle laws were very complex at that time. Who had written them? Where did they come from?
Well, most of the laws that we had in Oregon were either cribbed from the rules of the road, because, of course, the laws of vehicles apply to us because we are vehicles, and they were also sort of derived from what is the national sort of traffic code, and that's the Uniform Vehicle Code, which shortly after World War II in 1945 came out with a collection of uniform laws to suggest, and this had to do with the creation of the interstate highway system, to create some uniformity between the states. And while it's really not a uniform code in that it hasn't been adopted in whole, but it has in some ways been very influential. And to a large extent, our laws were the product of our legislators having looked at it. And also, we've been fortunate in Oregon because we had some legislative staffers who were bicyclists. And so we had some pretty darn good laws on the books. The problem was is that people in the court system, law enforcement, and even bicyclists and drivers themselves weren't really familiar with them because they hadn't been publicized in terms of what are the rules of the road from a bicyclist perspective.
Well, and it seems like if you had a hard time even looking at it and saying it was very technical, how is the average person going to interpret it to know what they were supposed to do?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I'm a lawyer, and I look at the laws applicable to my investigator's collision, and he's being blamed, but it seems to me like there are three or four pretty complex laws that apply to this. And I thought, well, I just wonder what's happened in other states. So then I started to study the laws in other states, and I realized, you know, most lawyers in general practice think they can represent somebody in a car wreck, and they don't really distinguish between that and a bike wreck. But what I found was that the laws are really substantially different.
Reading about cyclists in the 1890s and the year 1900, it's interesting to see that a lot of the issues that cyclists face today were the same then. There are reports of cyclists running over a chicken in a country road, of somebody with a cart blocking the path of a cyclist, and a little road rage. So there is a long history. I'm wondering, what are some of the most important Oregon laws that we should know about?
Well, I think the granddaddy of the laws, and I've got an orange legal rights card that we like to show folks, and I'm going to leave a few of these here. But I think the granddaddy of our laws is so typical of so many laws, and it'll just take me a minute or two to explain it. When you study the law, what you find out is that the law, even when it's granting rights, is really oftentimes phrased in the negative. So it's telling you what you can't do. And what you have to do is parse through all that language, and it's like taking a handful of pickup sticks, and every time the law says you can't do that, well, then you take a stick or two out. And what you get left after you take all those prohibited things out is what you can do. And the law didn't tell you what you could do. It told you what you couldn't do. So it takes a little bit of work to figure that out. So the granddaddy of all laws, which I consider our Bill of Rights, our right to the roadway, is the law that says that we have a right to be on the road, not just in a bicycle lane, but we've got a right to be on the road and to be treated with the rights of a car. Except that if we slow vehicles down, then we can't occupy the entire traffic lane. What we have to do is move as far to the right as practicable, which is just a fancy word for practical. And so what we can do, though, and this is like the gift of the law, if there's a condition which makes it so that we have to occupy the entire lane, such as a driver looking like they might open their car door, an animal, or let's say a obstruction in the road, or
you mean
a
pothole. Like, yeah, there's a pile of glass that wasn't there yesterday that somebody broke on the side of the road, and you need to go around it.
If we need to go around it, then we have a right to take the lane, even if it means that drivers have to slow down or stop behind us. We also have a right to make a left turn, just like a motorcycle or a motor vehicle. And the way you make a left turn is not from the far right side. You move over to the left side of the lane so that people can see a signal and turn. If that means that motorists have to slow down or stop behind us, so be it. That's our right to the road. So the name of the law is unlawful use of lanes, but it's really our grant of our right to the road. We can also ride side by side. And if we are making it so that drivers can't go around us, then we have to go single file. But that is our right to the road. And what it means is I can ride in any lane and wherever in the lane I want to, so long as I don't slow cars down at the normal speed of traffic, which I might say makes it so that we're not all deputized to enforce the speed limit, the normal speed of traffic is substantially faster than the speed limit. So sometimes I see bicyclists who are insisting on going, you know, 24 and a half miles an hour in a 25, and there are drivers that want to be going 32. The drivers are getting grumpy, but the bicyclists are saying, well, it's a speed limit of 25, I'm going fast enough. Well, you really don't have a right to impose that upon drivers. That's for law enforcement. If you're slowing people down, you really want to get out of their way. And that's what creates that cooperative sharing of the road that's so important.
And to clarify that, so I, for example, let's say we're on a country road where there's no shoulder. I'm going to ride not as close to the white line as I can. I'm going to, personally, I ride out usually where like the first wheel well of the car is for two reasons. One, it makes me more visible. And two, it forces the car to kind of go into oncoming traffic to pass me. So they're going to hopefully wait until they actually have safe space to pass. So if something happens as I'm traveling forward, if I was always all the way to the right and there was a pothole, I can't move over if they're trying to pass me between me and the yellow line. Is that legal?
Well, if once you, well, first of all, it's also a good idea to use that right tire track because it's a lot cleaner.
Yes, absolutely.
Than, you know, the tires sweep that tire track off. And so it's a lot easier to ride. But when you're, let's say, on a two-lane and in the rural area and it's 50-mile-an-hour speed limit, and you see yourself being overtaken, what you want to do is ride as far to the right as practicable. And practical is the same meaning. And is it practical to ride the fog line where there is a 2 or a 3 foot wide shoulder, which is one of these shared roadway situations, which is the trend in Oregon on the rural two lanes? You'll see that there are many widening projects. And the purpose of those widening projects is to take these old roads, widen that shoulder, and create a fog line that gives 2, 3, or even 4 feet to the outside of the fog line in order to create a shared use roadway. You know, the name for roadways in a lot of states is public way. And, you know, roadways are public ways. And they're for use by everybody, not just people in motorized vehicles. So if you give me that scenario and you've got a shoulder that's a shared shoulder.
No, there's no shoulder in that scenario.
So you don't have a situation where you've got a lot of margin for error when that car is passing you. If you ride right on the fog line and it's right next to the edge of the pavement and something happens, you're off the road and it's dangerous. So you're in a situation where what I would say would be riding that tire lane is the place to be. If the shoulder's wider, then moving over makes it easier for them to pass. And what I try to do is to, if I could have a t-shirt when I ride out in the rural areas, it would say, let me help you pass me. And that's because some of the biggest hazards that we have are from people who are passing us or turning in front of us. And I want to help them to get around me so that they're not in my worldview and I'm not holding them up. So you sometimes maybe you'll move over a little bit just to give them a chance to pass, give them a little hand signal to go around you, and then move over. What American motorists a lot of times think is that their driver's side tires are going to vaporize if they touch a double yellow line. Well, that's completely wrong. You drive in the third world, you drive in Europe, and people have a fluid and dynamic view of the roadway.
Yes.
And that, I like riding my bike in those areas because people are not just like rigid in their view about the shape of the roadway. That makes it so that we kind of team up to use the roadway because it's there for our use. It's
That's our a really, way. Really interesting observation that I recently, having been to Europe, hadn't really realized, but yeah, that I don't think I would have articulated it quite that way, but that's, I've definitely seen that.
If you're just tuning in, we're here with lawyer Ray Thomas. This is the KBO Bike Show, and Ray is talking about cyclists and the law. How can you protect yourself, what are your rights, when you're riding a bicycle or in a motor vehicle driving near bicycles? And Ray Thomas has extensive experience riding and advocating for cyclists. I'm interested in some of the other laws that developed over the years. I mean, you've been representing cyclists for a long time. How has the bicycle law changed in Oregon?
Well, in the two decades that I've been working actively in the legislature in Oregon, what we've done is we took that original set of laws we had and recognized that there were some that were really goofy. So not to hopefully confuse people, but it used to be that you couldn't pass on the right in the same lane so that if there was a line of cars, you couldn't move along the right of all these stopped cars. You had to stop behind the last car in the line and just sit there in exhaust fumes waiting for a light to change. So we passed a law that said you can pass on the right, I mean, not when you have a bike lane, but when you're sharing the traffic lane, when it's safe to do so, which is only common sense, and it followed the law in other states, which, again, creates sort of a fluid dynamic situation on the road. Another one that was really difficult was the bike lane law. You know, the good news is you get a bike lane. The bad news is you got to use it. And there's a law that says that if there's a bike lane, you have to use it. But the problem was that the law, the way it was formulated, made it so that you were then kidnapped by the bike lane. It was like you could never leave the bike lane. You were a trespasser if you left the bike lane. So what we tried to do, and this was the Bicycle Transportation Alliance Legislative Committee that worked on all these, was to create those common sense scenarios that you encounter where leaving the bike lane is necessary. So if there's a truck parked in front of the lane, if in the lane in front of you, if you have to pass somebody, if you want to turn left on a one-way, you need to move across lanes of traffic because you don't want to turn left from a bike lane on the right side of a multiple lane one-way street. Those were all times when you need to use a bike lane, or let's say that there's debris in the bike lane. And we passed that, and that again, you know, it reformed the law, and it made the law a better rule for us from this perspective of riders. So there's just a couple of examples.
And has the law paid attention to new technologies like the use of cell phones and texting machine by cyclists and drivers, mostly drivers?
Well, I think, you know, what we've got is this tension between personal liberties and efficient enforcement of traffic laws. In every community, most of us wish that there was more attention paid to law enforcement, particularly in regard to vehicle violence. And traffic violence is absolutely inconsistent with Vision Zero and the ways that we look at things. Plus, we've really got more skin in the game than most people because we don't have a steel exoskeleton around us. So, you know, from my perspective, I think speed cameras are a great idea. I think reducing traffic speeds within urban areas is a great idea. But you get a lot of pushback from some folks who feel like that's an infringement on their rights. So that there have been some good things that have come about, such as, for example, a recognition that you can go on red when the traffic light does not recognize your existence because you're riding a carbon or an aluminum frame bike and the magnetic loop doesn't pick up the fact that you're there.
Is that a Portland law or is that a statewide law?
That's a statewide law now.
Okay, good. When did that become law?
This last session.
Oh, great. I'm excited to know that, and I'm excited to learn that. It doesn't happen. Portland seems to be very good about making sure their magnetic readers work with bikes most of the time, but a lot of times in other cities, if you're riding a little farther out, it doesn't happen. So that's really good to know.
But, you know, the other thing is, I mean, we're talking all these pluses about Oregon, and Oregon's great, but we have failed to follow our Republican cohorts to the east in Idaho. They had a common sense, practical view. We don't want to pay the cost of signalizing intersections so that we've got these expensive detection devices. So what we're going to do is recognize that the old traffic signals sometimes don't pick folks up. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a stop, yield, and roll law so that bicyclists at a red signal, if there's nobody coming, once they stop, they can roll it. Or at a stop sign, if there's nobody coming, there's no reason for the bicyclist to come to a complete stop. They can roll through so long as they yield. And as you know, you can count on bicyclists to want to preserve their own lives. So we don't really flaunt the fact that we're at a stop sign by darting out in front of an oncoming vehicle just to try to muscle them or engage in what they call a NASCAR rough driving, because we don't have protection. So that law in Idaho, actually, there's been longitudinal epidemiologic studies at the University of California School of Public Health that have shown that there's been absolutely no increase in injury collisions in the state of Idaho as a result of enactment of these laws almost a decade ago. We tried three separate times to roll that law through the BTA in the Oregon legislature, and they just would not do it in Oregon. So you got to stop, and it, you know, you go to a stop signal and there's a red light and there's nobody around and you wonder, what the hell am I doing here? I don't understand it, but I gotta do this or else I might get a ticket.
Can you talk about some of the individual cases, individuals you represented and that have been important for the law, and also interesting cases by themselves?
Well, what we try to do when we see these collision cases is to think about what can we do and what can our client do if they've got the energy, or their family and friends do, to make it so that this is less likely to happen again. And it's been in as a result of these types of situations, for example, where we changed the law that gives bicyclists and pedestrians the right of way in marked and unmarked crosswalks, to recognize that you have the legal right to make the car stop when you take your bicycle wheel or tire and take it off of the curb and just put it down off the curb into the roadway. And that creates a legal obligation, as if you put a stop sign, for oncoming traffic to stop. Before then, it was sort of an unknown. And in fact, there's still a lot of confusion. Excuse me, by motorists, you see these pedestrians standing on the curb sort of looking wistfully toward approaching traffic. Well, the thing is that the reason that those drivers who know what the law is aren't stopping is because they don't have to stop until you take your foot or your crutch tip or your wheelchair wheel or your bicycle tire and just, like you're testing the temperature of the water, just take it and take it from the curb, and just, you don't have to step out into the killing zone, just take it off of the curb and set it on the roadway in the crosswalk, and that is the legal signal that creates your pedestrian right of way to cross that roadway, and oncoming traffic is required to stop. That was purely the result of bicyclists getting picked off and pedestrians getting picked off in crosswalks, when motorists were confused about, well, when is it that I really have to stop?
Well, and that's an interesting law or piece of legislature to bring up, because I think a lot of people are confused, both as a pedestrian or cyclist and as a driver, aren't sure what that moment is. And I find in Oregon that there's, or particularly in Portland, that there's a nice problem, that sometimes you're waiting on the sidewalk you don't want to cross, but somebody stops for you, or I'm on a bike and I'm at a stop sign and they have the right of way and they stop for me, but it's not the safest time for me to go. So it's nice to know that there's clarification on that, at least as far as the crosswalk goes.
And there is, that's a good point. And there is, the law says you have a right of way in the crosswalk. When a nice motorist stops for you and it's not at a crosswalk, one thing you need to recognize is that the other motorist may well not stop. So it's almost like a sucker punch, because here's this nice person kind of luring you out, and you get halfway out there, or your child gets halfway out there, and then some other motorist doesn't see or doesn't pay attention, and boom, they pick you off. Well, your legal rights didn't automatically occupy the space that that nice person created for you in somebody else's lane.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a cyclist who was hit, I believe, last year out on a rural road, and that was a situation that was similar but a little bit different, in that the motorist didn't wave her through, but she had the right of way, but the motorist waved another car through, and that car hit her.
Yeah, and we have, in our office, been, we go through sort of different campaigns, and one of the campaigns we have right now is somewhat connected with this nice problem, and that is situations where a driver either waves a bicyclist through and the bicyclist gets hit, or they wave a vehicle through and the vehicle they wave through then hits a bicyclist because
right.
the waver failed to look to see that there was a bicyclist coming in the bike lane alongside them. And we've had a number of cases where actually we have now sued the waver, because what we want to do is to have people realize that you are assuming responsibilities under the law that you didn't have by indicating to somebody to go ahead. You're sort of taking responsibility
Absolutely.
For them.
Yeah.
We're here today on the KBO Bike Show with lawyer Ray Thomas. We're talking about cyclists and our rights and responsibilities. Ray, you've written that our state's legislature has all too frequently passed laws that increase the domination of internal combustion vehicles. I'm not sure when you wrote it, but I'm wondering, what's the next step for bicycle law? What are some areas that you'd like to see changed or added?
Well, I think the if you look at Oregon, I think our situation is a little different from the rest of the country, because we have had some great success in reforming the laws. In other states, I think that the Oregon code has created, I think, a good system. It's not perfect, but what we've been doing a lot of lately is trying to acquaint folks in other states with some of the things that the Oregon legislature has done so that they can incorporate those things into their own states. In Oregon, I think the biggest thing right now is just making it so that Oregon drivers learn about the changes that have occurred in the traffic code. The problem is that most drivers, if you were to look at when was it that you, quote, learned about the traffic law, it was in driver's training when they were in high school, and that was decades ago, before many of these legal changes went into effect. For example, in Oregon 2007, the law about passing bicyclists changed considerably. It used to be a safe distance, and I know your later guest is going to talk about a device to detect a 3-foot passing lane zone. So in Oregon in 2007, the law was changed to allow a fall over distance such that at speeds above 35 miles an hour, if the bicyclist were to fall into the lane of traffic, the distance that the motorist is to follow to go around that motorist would be such that the motorist wouldn't hit the bicyclist. I think that's a great gauge. Anybody who's ever been passed at 3 feet or 2 feet by a motorist at highway speeds knows that it's an awful experience. And I have an article in this month's or quarter's League of American Bicyclists magazine and online asking the question, is 3 feet enough? And the argument that we make in it is that 3 feet really isn't enough at highway speeds for a semi-truck to pass a bicyclist. And
No way. Know, that's well enough. Into the draft to get sucked in under those wheels.
And, you know, that is...
At least that's my opinion, I should.
Well, that's a knowable and known feature of highway riding by bicyclists, and any truck driver, whoever wonders about it, should go out and try it for themselves on a bicycle, because that's exactly right. So,
well, you mentioned a minute ago too that like a lot of laws have changed. I think one of the difficulties that we have in the United States, I traveled for a bit in New Zealand, and there they have a very definite, if something happens, they have billboards and what would you call it, like a public education campaign from the government that comes out if they change laws so that people are educated in laws. And here, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of public service announcements or things that will tell people and update them on that law, except maybe a byline in the newspaper when it happens.
Well, that's exactly right. And the problem is that, you know, law enforcement and the media have a great opportunity when they report on these collisions to put one sentence in about what the law in Oregon is regarding this. They don't have to say who is at fault. And merely citing the law is something that I think people would be interested in. And it's just laziness. to fail to do that, because if law enforcement and the reporters and the editors would take and make themselves students of the law, which they should be, it's not hard to take a look at pedal power or an Oregon vehicle code and say the law requires that passing distance be fall over distance, or bicyclists have the right of way in a bike lane, which means that when persons are turning in motor vehicles, they must yield to bicyclists, or pedestrians and bicyclists both have the right of way in crosswalks, which means we must yield to them in a marked or an unmarked crosswalk. Those are the little things that can be added really simply to make it so that people understand what the laws are.
Well, Ray, we're getting up on the first half of the hour. If people would like, our listeners would like more information about where to find the legal guide, or where to find even just the quick handouts that you guys have made, where's the best places to find those?
Well, you can download these things as PDFs at our website, which is stc-law.com, and it's all there. And I also wrote a pedestrian law book in Oregon, and it's there. And we also have these rights cards. And one of the things that we're going to talk a little bit about today is how Oregonians have a little-known right to prosecute drivers in traffic court when the police can't or won't do it for traffic violations. And we've got a action pamphlet, I call it. It's red. That's on our website that it can also be downloaded, and it's like a recipe book.
And will you take a minute actually before we wrap up and speak to that law, that action that you're talking about?
Absolutely. So a number of bicycle lawyers and riders have been in a situation where they've seen or been involved in a situation where they've been right hooked, or a motorist has muscled them in the bike lane, or they've been in a collision and no citations were issued. And when they go to the police can't or won't do anything. But there's a 6-month statute of limitations, which means you got to do it within 6 months. But a bicyclist in Oregon, and I don't know of another state that has a law like this, so we're very fortunate here, may actually initiate a traffic law violation themselves as a citizen, and the police are required to file and serve it for them. And if the driver pleads not guilty to this violation, which goes all the way up from to careless driving at the most severe, but includes, you know, failure to yield to a bicyclist in a bike lane, if the motorist contests it, then it goes to a traffic court and in the county, and there's a little trial just like on a traffic ticket. And at the conclusion of that, if the person is found guilty, it's the same as if a police officer had issued the citation. It goes to DMV, becomes part of their permanent record. The traffic judge imposes a fine or some sort of alternative. And this is a way to kind of even the odds on the roadway. And we've got on our website, if you go to our website and go and look under resources under bike and pedestrian law, you'll see the stories in regular words, not legalese.
Thank
from
you.
a number of people who have actually done this. And many times they've been met with mystified looks when they went into the courthouse to try to initiate it or the police station. But now, for example, Portland Traffic Department is quite conversant with this, as is the Multnomah County Clerk's Office. And in Portland, everybody's pretty well trained to do it. So I'd encourage you, if you get into a situation where you might want to consider this, read the pamphlet and consider it for yourself.
We're here on the KBO Bike Show, and you're listening. You've just heard Ray Thomas, lawyer Ray Thomas. Please stay with us for the second half of our show when we continue our conversation about cycling and the law. In the second half of the show, we'll be joined by Christopher Stanton, developer of the world's first system that detects how close a car is passing you, and Officer Robert Simmons of the Chattanooga Police Department, one of the first cities to use this system in its law enforcement. So don't touch that dial.
Good morning. You are tuned in to the KBOO Bike Show, and today we're focusing on cycling and the law. Have you ever been just riding along, minding your own business on your commute to work or a ride on the weekend and had a car pass you way, way too close? Or have you been driving and passed a cyclist with what you thought was plenty of room, only to be met at the next stoplight or in your rearview mirror with a few choice words or gestures? In the second half of our show today, our guest will share with you a whole new technology that could change perceptions from both angles. I'd first like to introduce Christopher Stanton, co-creator of C3FT, that's C3 feet, technology, a system that allows a rider to register and record exactly how close a vehicle is passing. He's also the executive director of the Casello Cycling Initiative, a cycling education and advocacy initiative in Austin, Texas, and the chair of the City of Austin's Bicycle Advisory Council. Christopher, good morning and welcome to the show.
Hey, Tori, thanks for having me on.
Yes, and we're also joined by Officer Robert Simmons at the Chattanooga, Tennessee Police Department. Officer Simmons not only works on the department's bike patrol, but he is also a police cyclist instructor and the first user of the C3FT system. Welcome to the show, Officer Simmons.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Thank you both so much for joining us this morning. Christopher, for our listeners who can't see on air, we have a photo of your device on of the C3FT on our Facebook page. But can you describe what it looks like when it's mounted on the handlebar and how it works?
So C3FT has two main components. One is a sensor buoy that's off on the kind of line with the left edge of the bicycle, and that's where the ultrasonic device or sensor is that actually does the detection. And then it has a central display unit or head unit, which kind of has the brains of the device, as well as some buttons, some readouts, and then the digits displaying the number of inches from the edge of the bike.
And how
there's a third
go ahead.
And then there's a third component, which is, you know, we have an arm that you attach an off-the-shelf camera to both record the display unit, the bicycle's position and behavior within the road, and then the driver's pass and post-pass behavior.
And how accurate can the device measure the distance?
Plus or minus 1 inch.
Excellent. That's pretty darn accurate.
And this is Alon Rob, the co-host. Good morning to both of you. Can it be used on all bikes? And also, Christopher, how did you come up with this idea?
So, yes, it can be used on all bikes. Most police bikes are kind of standard mountain bikes or city bikes. But in Austin, a couple of police officers that have been using it, they ride cyclocross and or road bikes, and so it can successfully mount onto drop bars and all of that. The one that is being used for education and enforcement activities is actually version 2. We developed version 1, I think, back in 2012, and it was developed mainly as kind of a research device to do statistical data gathering on driver pass and post-pass behavior on a range of different facility designs and then rider positions within those facilities. But then we received interest from both the advocacy community doing education and as well as the police community who wanted to do, you know, education and enforcement for a device that could be more of a, you know, ruggedized off-the-shelf model that could get just drop shipped to them.
And we're going to bring in Officer Simmons in a moment here, but before we get there, I'm really curious, what did your results of your research find on the average passing distances and things like that?
We had, you know, during those, we were pretty careful in how we were doing our data gathering, because, you know, we have a cyclist. We aren't trying to intentionally invite close passes.
No.
As we all know, that puts the cyclist in danger. We didn't have as many as we thought we would. But there was a couple of places where we were legally riding that we decided not to continue testing because we had a large amount of harassment. The harassment was verbal and threats and kind of threatening with the car, but not actually getting extra close, which possibly is because the driver didn't necessarily understand how close they were. But we didn't, you know, from a statistical standpoint, we were trying to get data on whether or not these facilities were functional. and we didn't find a large amount of problems with the facilities themselves.
And is 3 feet adequate for a distance between a cyclist and a car?
It depends. So in Austin, we actually have a two-phase rule. One is a three-foot rule for the vulnerable users law, where normal vehicles, you know, cars and light trucks, are supposed to be outside of 3 feet. And then we have a second phase, which is a six-foot rule, which is for 18-wheelers and box trucks, dump trucks.
Oh, that's smart.
I heard the original part of your guys' talking about speeds. And so one interesting thing is we don't have one that's based off of speeds, but Australia does. So in Australia, they have a split rule. So if the vehicle speeds are below 60 kph, which ends up being about 37.5 miles per hour, they have a 1 meter law, which is about 3 feet. If the marked speeds for the road are above 60 kph, so 37.5 miles per hour or so, they have a 1.5 meter law, which is about 5 feet. So theirs is actually variable based off speed, since speed is one of the main factors for risk.
Interesting. Well, we also have Officer Robert Simmons of the Chattanooga Police Department here with us. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
In many cities across the United States, cyclists find that some officers are less than helpful when it comes to understanding what it's like to be on two wheels on the roadway, but Chattanooga, just by even taking on this technology, seems different. What would you describe as the culture and circumstances that allowed you to be a trailblazer with the C3FT?
Absolutely. First off, in my opinion, it's not less than helpful, maybe. It's more of ignorance. Our culture is one of experience versus non-experience. Or other words, people who ride a bike and people who don't. And as you talked with the lawyer in the prior interview, these officers, just like motorists who don't ride a bike, have trouble relating to cyclists because they've never been in that situation. They don't know how it feels to have a car pass really closely or a truck backdraft coming back on you because it passed too closely. But I believe Chattanooga is different, like you said. The circumstances here in Tennessee was that our city was growing in an outdoor capacity and a multimodal capacity. We just became a cycling city. We have great roads, great bike trails in this area. So cycling became bigger and bigger and bigger, and it allowed me to push the education the way I have. When Christopher was talking about the device, there is a part of the device that has a GoPro camera on it. And I record both the device and the car passing with a wide-angle lens on the GoPro camera. And when a motorist passed me within a certain amount of inches or whatever, we'll stop them for the violation. And I'll actually sync my tablet up to the camera and bring it to the driver of the vehicle and show them in a first-person perspective what it feels like to have a car pass that close. And honestly, a lot of the people that I stop don't realize this. They're thinking from their closed compartment. They can't even hear the wind or feel the wind. So it's really eye-opening to show them that first-person perspective of what it's like.
That is so amazing, because I think I realized how valuable the C3FT could be from an enforcement perspective, but I hadn't added in the tablet, thinking that you would have a tablet on you to be able to show people. That's really, really another piece of technology that's just, you know, 10 years ago, we couldn't do that.
And Officer Simmons, I'm curious about how you became so interested in bicycles. Did you always ride a bike? I think you're on bike patrol now. How did that come about?
Yes, I've been riding bikes, of course, since I was a kid, like a lot of us. I started getting into mountain biking before I was on bike patrol. I've been a police officer for 13 years, and the past 7 of those years, I've been full-time bike patrol here in the city. So I think my interest in cycling definitely increased. When you ride a bike 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, you tend to come across everything that normal cyclists come across. I've been hit times on duty. I've had very close passes, and
you've been
and
hit actually, in your uniform.
Yes, this uniform.
Was that intentional everything. Or just accident?
There was one intentional one. He was trying to get away, but the other two had just been careless driving and not paying attention.
Wow.
Well, hopefully you healed and you don't need the lawyer Ray Thomas who was here on the first half of the show.
No, I don't think I need one of those. But what started the Safe Biking Initiative that we are doing here, that I'm doing here in Chattanooga. 4 years ago, a cyclist by the name of David Meek was killed by a passing truck. He was doing everything right. He was riding early in the morning, so he had flashy lights, he had headlights, he had a fluorescent vest on. He was on the right side of the road. However, a truck passed him, caught one of his panniers, and it pulled him under the truck, and it killed him. That resonated with me for several years, actually. And I couldn't understand how someone could be doing everything right and get killed. And then the investigation agency, the police department, when they investigated, they really didn't find the truck at fault. They just found it unavoidable, is what they called it. And it really, it ticked me off, and especially being part of that organization. So it resonated with me, and finally we got a new chief recently who actually used to work for Austin, Texas, where Christopher lives. He came in, and I told him about the issues that I were having with cycling and not in the education, both on the law enforcement side and the motorist side, and he kind of just gave me the courage and the push to actually start the initiative. I told him that someone needed to educate the police and the public, and he said, well, guess what? That's you.
There you go.
On my shoulders. So he's really the one, and we borrowed from the Austin PD. They had a similar initiative, but they didn't have the device at that time. So I was able to incorporate the device, and what I did is I started asking other departments nationwide how they enforce the 3-foot rule, and every single one of them came back and said, you can't. It's impossible. It's the opinion of an officer judging a distance, 1 to 3 feet, from a distance behind the actual where it's occurring, and then when you get to court, defense attorneys are gonna tear you up. You can't. It's like me sitting on the side of the road and seeing you speed by in your car, pull you over and write you a speeding ticket, and then go into court, and the defense attorney is going to ask me, well, how fast were they going? Well, I don't know. Well, how do you know they were speeding? Well, my experience? So it's really difficult to win in court, so I really wanted some kind of electronic device, and due to the connections we had with my chief in Austin, he knew Christopher, and he was able to put me in contact with him, and I was able to explain to Christopher what law enforcement needed. And of course, and Christopher will tell you that he didn't know what law enforcement needed. For he knew he had the technology, but he didn't know what would he be held in court, and that's where the camera came into play, and I told him exactly what I needed for my type of bicycling and what I need to when I get crossed in court. And he was able to develop that and something that's very usable and is used every day here in Chattanooga.
So, Christopher, most of us are familiar with radar for catching speeds, but for this application, you're using an ultrasonic detector. What is an ultrasonic detector, and how does it measure it, the accuracy within an inch? It seems like it would be really difficult. Like, you're moving on the bicycle, the vehicle's moving past you. How does all that work?
All right, so, you know, ultrasound, you know, it's used much in the same way that the police officers use radar or laser for speed. So ultrasound is just compression waves versus being radiation, and it's perpendicular to the target. And so it really is sending out waves and receiving reflections, just like sonar, right? So it would be like sonar for the air. And, you know, it has high enough sample rates that we're able to accurately gather distances for passing vehicles. And, you know, you have the different kind of velocities that you could get up onto a normal city road. And we've done that up to, you know, quite a high passing rate and haven't had any issues. So that's where we get the actual distance measurement off the side of a vehicle using the ultrasound sensor. And then the camera itself is useful both to capture that data for a court record, but also, you know, there's other violations that can come into play. You know, let's say the driver passes you at 3 feet, but then chops back into the in front of you. So it'd be an unsafe pass, even though it was outside of 3 feet to start with.
And Christopher, what is the cost of the system, and are there any other police departments that are getting them across the world?
Yes, so it's $1,400, and it's made in the U.S. We actually fabricate all the devices here in Austin, Texas. We have devices in Florida, in Houston, in Chattanooga. We've sold to a group in Canada, and then we have interest from some groups in all across the U.S. We have inquiries from a whole bunch of municipalities and police departments, and also the in Australia. That's how I know about the Australia law. So we've actually had to do some modifications to the device to handle countries that are using metric instead of standard, which would be every country except for like the U.S. and one other one.
And you said that that's kind of spread around. How long has the device been used in Chattanooga?
When was that, Robert? Was that in May or June,
March.
I think?
Actually, March? I think the end of May, yeah. March or May. Mm-hmm.
That's so it's only been a few months, and it's already spread that far. And is it only police departments, or is it also advocacy groups? Is there anyone else purchasing these?
Yeah, it's actually a mix. So some are police departments, some are advocacy groups, and then some are, like in Canada, that's a municipality that purchased it. But ones that are actually being purchased by advocacy groups are actually being purchased, you know, not just for their internal use, but to then be used by their local police department. So like Houston Ghost Bike in Houston purchased one because they're very focused on having this, you know, there's a lot of auto bicycle collisions occurring in Houston and a bunch of deaths. And so they are really pushing hard for Houston Police Department to utilize the device in enforcement and education. But a lot of police departments, their funding mechanisms are more complicated than it would be for an external agency. And so Houston Ghost Bike purchased one to then provide to Houston Police Department to use for those actions.
And for this question is for both of you. For those of us who haven't visited your cities ever or recently, what is it like to ride a bike over there? Are they good bicycle cities?
Do you want to start first, Officer Simmons?
Yeah, we recently are becoming a more cycling city. The mayor has just took on a challenge, which is a nationwide challenge, to create a multimodal environment. And right now, actually, as I speak, I'm actually sitting in my car and I'm looking at one of the bike lanes being painted in our city, and they're actually putting up protected lanes downtown where the cyclists can ride without fear of traffic, you know, coming in on them as much, because it's protected by a barrier. So we are becoming more and more of a cycling city. We actually have now the Ironman is hosted here in this area, and the National Cycling Championships are here every year.
I believe Outside Magazine in their last issue just voted you the most livable city if you're an outdoor person in the U.S.
So. Yeah, we have kayaking, cycling, mountain biking, climbing. It's all near here, so we're very, very fortunate.
And Christopher, can you tell us a little bit about the conditions in Austin?
Well, other than it being 105, 110 sometimes in the summer, it's great. You know, Austin is a pretty solid city to ride in. You know, there's lots of facilities. We have protected bike lanes. We have a very good group of engineers in the city staff in the active transportation department, as well as public works with urban trails and safe routes to school. Our biggest challenge right now is that because Austin is growing so rapidly that our, you know, on-road facilities are struggling to deal with the influx of drivers. And so that kind of causes more situations for conflict because everybody is kind of stuck in traffic, and that causes frustration, and frustration causes behavior, or poor behavior at times. We have a bicycle master plan that got passed a couple years ago, and so there's a lot of work going towards building that out. But, you know, my day job is teaching kids to use their bikes as transportation. So, you know, the parks, the pool, their friends' house, and school. And we're in 17 sites, and a lot of those are elementary schools all the way up through high school. And it's great riding with those kids. It's safe. We ride on the trails, sidewalks, and the roads. Like any city, you have to kind of pick your facilities some. There's roads that are not good, and there's roads that are great. But across the board, I'd say Austin is doing very well. Our biggest challenge is just, the city itself growing at such a rate that the city can't keep up with.
Absolutely. We're seeing the exact same thing in Portland. I think they're saying that Portland's population might double by 2032 at this point. And so we are struggling with exactly the same thing. And recently, actually, we had an interesting case go through that a rider was passed. He had a GoPro camera on the front of him. He was passed on a very narrow residential street, the kind of street where maybe one car can go in each direction. And he was passed with an oncoming cyclist coming at them well above the speed limit and very close. He also had his child on the bike. And they were able, because it was visibly, you were visibly able to see by the GoPro camera, to be able to tell, and he was able to pursue a citizen-activated citation, and he brought the video into the police, and the police actually, in that case, took over and went after the guy, and the guy was actually cited for both careless driving and unsafe passing, which is a miracle. I think that's the first time that both those things have happened because of a video. But the $1,400 price tag for the C3FT is a little high for the consumer, your average person. Is there any hope for a consumer model to come out for people who are using a GoPro and things like that right now?
Right. So at this point, no, because this isn't, it's not a kind of a mass market device. These are fabricated in-house in Austin, Texas. They're not a high volume device when it comes to the ability to fabricate them, which would then bring the price down some. In the scheme of things, I would say the casual consumer wouldn't be our main client. It would be an advocacy group in the city or a police department or municipality. Houston Ghost Bike did a GoFundMe to purchase theirs, and they raised the money in, I think, 5.5 hours.
That wasn't a problem.
there's obvious demand, and for Portland, I don't think in Austin we have the ability to kind of activate traffic tickets based off of personal experience. And by that I mean like me as an individual seeing it happen versus needing an officer to visually see the infraction. And that's a pretty interesting law. And so I could see that being something that'd be functional in Portland, but it could also be like the device is a kind of like a tool share. Let's say that there's a known area in town that there are close passes happening, then advocacy organization in Austin, in Portland, could have a device or two that they loan out to a cyclist to go then ride that route to do their own kind of enforcement activity.
Or even research to say, hey, this is a problem, and bring the numbers to the city.
Yeah, and say, hey, this is a place that you guys could maybe go and do some enhanced enforcement activities because we've shown that there is a high rate of infractions occurring.
Yeah. Well, thank you both so much. We're getting, unfortunately, close to the end of the hour. It has been excellent having you both here. Christopher, if people want to find out more about the C3FT device, where should they go?
C3FT.com, and they can email us there, find us more information. There's a kind of info sheet that gives a general overview of the device and its functions and target markets.
Well, Officer Robert Simmons, I want to thank you not only for being on the show, but for all the hard work you do out there as a law enforcement officer and as an educator for cyclists and pedestrian rights.
Well, thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
And Christopher Stanton, co-developer of the C3FT, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the KBOO Bike Show here on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. We're on the air the first Wednesday of every month. Thanks to our guests, Lawyer Ray Thomas, Officer Robert Simmons, and Christopher Stanton for joining us today. To find out more about information about the C3FT, you can go to their website at c3ft.com, which will also be linked later today on our Facebook page. If you have missed the show and you're just tuning in, you want to hear more, all our shows are podcasts and archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. And you can also find our most recent episodes for free on iTunes. Special thanks to our brilliant podcast engineer, Josh Hetrick, to Portland Transport and Chris Smith for hosting our podcast. The Bike Show is hosted and organized by myself, Alon Robb, and Jocelyn Gowdy. Thanks to our magical in-studio engineer, Tammy, without whom we would be fumbling through the airspace. And thanks to all you listeners out there. Ride safe and keep two wheels down.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KABU, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House. Also by Portland Saturday Market, from our hands to yours, celebrating 42 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from February 28th through Christmas Eve. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com. And thirdly, by Deakum Street Doorway, a Linton feed and seed store offering essentials for farm life in the city, including animal feeds, garden and landscape plants from local farms and nurseries, and seed garlic